And hello, and welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and we're on the web at kuci.org. We're also at iTunes on College Radio. Today is Wednesday, April 8th, 2015. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and my guest today for the entire hour is Stephen Dunn. Stephen is a Pulitzer Prize-winning poet with 17 collections of poetry. He's been awarded fellowships from the Guggenheim and Rockefeller Foundations and many other prizes. He's here to talk about his most recent collection, Lines of Defense. And before we bring him on, let me just say that the opinions and views that you hear on this show are not those of the University of California Regents, but those of me and my guest. Let's bring him on. Hi, Stephen.
Hi, Barbara. How are you?
Great. Great to have you back. I've said this before, but no doubt we have new listeners who haven't heard the past show we did. And I wanted to say that I discovered you when I lived in San Francisco and took buses and trolleys to work. And there on a trolley or bus was one of your poems. I guess San Francisco had a Poetry on the Buses program going on at the time. And I've been a fan ever since, and one thing I loved then and I love now about your work is that while you poke fun at the foibles of human beings, you also have this great empathy that comes through your work. Is that, I can't imagine that's on purpose.
I think it's the job of the writer is to enter the other, to be another, and that's a form of empathy, I suspect. And I'm always surprised when people say, how did you know that? Let's say I'm writing in the voice of a woman. If I were a novelist, you know, nobody would ask that question. That'd be my job.
Right.
I'm supposed to do that.
Yeah, that's interesting. And actually, I wanted to talk about the voice because you know, some of the poems, I imagine, are written from the point of view of a persona that you're taking on, and others are from your own personal point of view. I don't know, how does that work for you? And does the poem dictate persona, or do you dictate which it's going to be?
Well, you know, the poems that seem most personal are poems I can write when I'm not interested in myself too much, which is paradoxical, but true enough. I often start poems without any clear indication of where I'm going. Those poems take their inspiration from the language I find myself using. But the poems that are or seemingly experiential, I used to write those poems out of thinking my experience was important. I no longer do, or that anybody should be interested in my life. I don't think that follows either. I start to write these poems with a very cold eye and without any sense of trying to be therapeutic or understand myself better. I'm trying to make something interesting, really. And it happens in various ways. So, but nevertheless, I want the voice to sound trustworthy all the time.
How about the first poem in Lines of Defense? It was a time. Mm-hmm. Would you read that? Would you read that
I
to
will.
Us? Okay.
Find it here. Should be the first poem, right? yeah. It was a time. Some of us just wanted to drop out, go far away from integrity's demand. Others sought strange consultation with their almost vanished selves. And the brave, they would meet somewhere in zero weather to subvert the drift of the land. It was a time to link arms or cross the border. And who were you and who was I? Such questions seem like a lifelong job. We put the world on notice, and the world hardly noticed when we occupied the offices of people who just wanted to do their jobs and go home. We thought we'd done something historical, bold. We desired to be as compelling as Belmondo with a cigarette, Monica Vitti looking just so. But always the familiar banalities would return, an existential day followed by a comfortable night, the rhapsodies of achievement, then a great smalling down. No one could be sure what was true. In time, we became people we only occasionally knew.
Thank you so much. I love this poem. Will you talk about this, where this came from, how this came out, and how this came to be the first poem in the book?
I'll try. I don't know. I don't remember, really. It seemed like a pastiche of several poems, lesser poems I had lying around that didn't work. And it became a poem about the 60s and the early 70s. But that was not my intention when I began. I'm not sure what my intention was, but it started to collect its details because maybe mid-poem I discovered what I was doing. And then tried to be... try to get it right, try to get that time right for myself and but also for many others.
So does a poem then make you sit down? Well, it sounds like they happen different ways. I mean, this one, it doesn't sound like you sat down to write this. It's found its way out and through revision became what it is. But
Does
it also happen that a poem sort of calls to you and you have to sit down and get it out? Does it happen like that?
Rarely. It used to happen more like that. I think if I wait for outside inspiration, I'd write two or three poems a year. Unless some people have more interesting lives than I do. I think of myself as a maker of poems, not as an utterer of experience. So it's but they do happen variously. I think in this book, probably most of the poems began without any clear intention. There's maybe two or three where I knew what I was doing for early on. I usually discover what I'm doing in the course of writing. And then you have to stitch and leave it, put things in, leave things out to make it seem like your mind was shapely all along. When in fact it took a lot of work to make it seem that way.
This poem reminds me of perhaps the first poem. I don't know if it was the one on the bus or one of the first poems I read of yours called Contact. I think it was written in 78, or it was in a publication that came out in 78. And it's a certain sensibility of yours where you're sort of looking back and you very poignant, feeling comes through and sensible too. I don't know. Is that sort of a...
I could remember the poem Contact. I don't.
Well, it begins. I have it right here. It begins. I don't have the whole thing right here, but I have the beginning because I took a picture of what I copied down, that I kept this piece of paper that is now very crinkly and brown. And it says Contact for Ron Banner.
I remember that. That one.
Yeah. Yes. Wants to make friends with friends.
Yeah.
I love that poem, and it has the same feeling as it was a time.
Yeah, well, the difference was, I think, is that that poem was based on real experience. This poem is an amalgam of experiences. It was a time. And I did know a Ron Banner, and he was a friend, and he was not a friend. He was a strange friend, and he I think, as I recall now, it was a way of talking about what I think of as the oddness of California.
Mm-hmm.
If you allow that,
I will. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, that poem just really struck me, so much so that I had to copy the whole thing down, and it's a very long poem.
Yes.
It's very long, and I love it. So how many revisions might you put a poem through then? I mean, I think writers who are not poets might have the idea that poetry comes out, you futz a little, and it's done.
Well, that's happened a few times. More often than not, I go through 30, 40, 50 drafts. Hofstra University, where I went as an undergraduate, has my papers, and every year I send them my drafts of poems. And sometimes I clip together, 40, 50 drafts, sometimes 5 or 6, sometimes 10. But always it takes... my mind is not clear until it's clear, and I have some good friends who keep me honest, also like my wife and Larry Robb, and even poems that I think are there, they have had correct objections to that make me see it in a slightly different way, or just change a word or two. It's very hard to get the world right, I think. And I think one of my favorite comments by John Berger, I'm only going to paraphrase, is that it takes all the precision we can muster to be true to the ambiguities of life.
Hmm. That's good.
And... That's what I'm after, and it takes a lot of doing, but it's fun doing. I enjoy the act of revision.
Mm. You are listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with poet Stephen Dunn. His latest collection is called Lines of Defense, published by Norton. And when we booked the show, I had no thought to the fact that it's considered that April is considered National Poetry Month. What do you think about that? Do you like that, or do you just wish every month was National Poetry Month and that we paid attention?
I wish the latter. I guess it's helpful in some ways that this is a declared month. I imagine it's how African Americans feel, a good many feel about February, that they wish that every month was their month. And poetry is largely neglected in America and in the schools. I'm preparing a little speech. I haven't started writing it yet, but I've been asked to give the keynote speech at the National Council of Teachers of English next November. And I want to give a little lecture on why poetry is not built into the curriculum. And so I'm starting to think about that. I don't have anything formal. I have ideas, of course, but I don't have anything formulated to tell you. I think I should probably save it for then anyway.
Well, it seems too that the poetry that most kids, if they get any poetry at all in school, the poetry they get is poetry they can't relate to.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems that poetry, the classics, should come after you've already engaged a student.
I think that's absolutely true, With me, it happened rather late. It didn't happen with the poems I learned in college, even, or I was taught in college. I started to find poets when I was about 23 or so who spoke to my life, who entranced me with language, or sometimes they either spoke to the conditions of my life, or like, say, Wallace Stevens, they captivated me with their music and language and their wildness. Something has to happen to engage you. You can't say somebody, you must love this because it's great literature.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But then you should move toward great literature.
Yeah,
it's good for anybody who wishes to write to know as much as they can about what they're doing.
Hmm.
It's like carpenters not knowing how to use hammers or something. you got to know all your tools.
Right. Right, and probably if you're interested in woodworking, you're going to mess around with it first and not spend all your capital on buying the tools until you know you love it, and then it's time to really seriously learn.
Yeah, I became a voracious reader of contemporary poetry. When I went to graduate school, when I was around 30, I was so far behind everybody else who I had been a history major, who knew everybody, and I just read everything at once, it seemed. So I'm not even sure what my influences are, because it was all such a rush of stuff. I have people I return to, of course, but...
Who do you return to?
I return to Frost, to Stevens a lot lately, it changes a great deal about who I've been reading. I'm trying to think of it. I've been reading some contemporaries over and over. There's a wonderful book by Margaret Gibson called Broken Cup, which I love, and Alicia Ostreicher has a book called, I think, 70. One of the best books about becoming older that I know, which definitely speaks to my condition, even though she speaks from a woman's perspective. I don't know, I've been reading less and less, actually, because I always used to read at night, and now I fall asleep.
Oh, it's the best way to go to sleep.
I guess.
I wonder if you would read again. I have a couple of poems marked, actually. One is Betty Friedan's Final Advice on on 35.
Yeah, yeah.
And if you just tuned in, you are listening to Writers on Writing. I am with poet Stephen Dunn. His latest collection is Lines of Defense.
Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know if this is Betty Friedan's final advice. It's how I wish her final advice would have been.
Okay.
It may have been. Okay. Betty Friedan's final advice. If you want it to last, it's important to get off to a good start. Don't let a ship's captain marry you unless he's adept at changing course. Don't let any dogma have its day. No doubt, though, society will want some kind of priest to officiate. Say the words you must say, but be sure to violate all the stupid stuff. Or why not hire someone, say, 12 credits short of being an expert, who can sing and knows something about serious fun. After the ceremony, change into that funky outfit that drives only the right men crazy. Hope your husband will be one of them. Heed the intelligence of outright lust. But invite those women friends that drives crazy, too. Always anticipate a just-in-case scenario. Make reservations at an Indonesian French restaurant whose specialty is called pleasure for more than one. Speak your best velvety French. Tell your man one of your fantasies is taking off a cummerbund while pronouncing its name. Recommend he keep his on for a while. Tell him you have nothing against God, but remember only an insecure God, like an insecure man, insists that a woman must obey. Remind him that all the Bible stories were written by men. Your job now is to define what heavenly is, and heaven itself, and find ways to let him in.
Thank you. I love that. I love that poem. Talk a little bit about that. I mean, you said you wish or would hope this would be Betty Friedan.
She was awfully smart, and I think by the time she died, she had effected a lot of change. And I would hope that she would have come around more to the worthiness of some men, anyway, and would have said something like this, it's a what if poem.
I love it. We're going to take a very short break. We'll be right back. So all of you out there, stay with us. We'll be right back with more Stephen Dunn. Don't go anywhere. Welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting from the University of California Irvine campus. We're on the web at KUCI.org and at iTunes at College Radio. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. I've been here since 9 a.m. Pacific time with Stephen Dunn, and we'll bring him back on. Hey there. You know, you had mentioned poetry in school, in college, and I'm guessing there's a lot of listeners out there that don't know sort of your background in advertising. I'd love that little story.
It's not really a background in advertising. I never wrote advertising, but I did work for Nabisco, and I wrote and designed brochures for salesmen. It was an in-house publication, and I probably the advertising thinking about it was when at age 25 or so, I was offered a very big job within the company, which was advertising, promotion, and sales relations manager. And that's when I quit. I never did any of that stuff.
And is that when you went to Europe? I'm trying to...
Yeah, I went to Spain.
Yes.
Yeah, I lived on $2,200, my then wife and I, for 11 months. Something you couldn't do now, but it was the most important thing I had done in my life.
Why is that?
Well, it was a way of... This will sound too melodramatic, but it's kind of melodramatic. It was a way of saving my life. I did not want to be the kind of people that were in that office.
Mm-hmm.
And they were nice people and all, but I didn't want to be them. And I thought I certainly wouldn't have anything resembling a soul had I stayed there.
Well, you know, that sort of leads into the next question, which is, what's the best training for a poet, or perhaps any writer?
The best training, you say?
Yeah. I mean, is it, you know, a lot of writers, mm-hmm. when they figure it out, they, you know, after they get their BA, they go to graduate school, get into an MFA program, and hope for the best. So I wonder what you think of that, and what you think the best training is.
Well, one of the things I've been saying to people who ask about younger poets especially, they need to treat it as an art, the way other artists, the way other would-be artists do, which means lots of practice, lots of reading everything, you wouldn't think of a dancer, somebody who wanted to be a dancer, not being limber, for example, or a violinist not practicing every day. So it's a question of taking yourself seriously and knowing what that means. And graduate school was fine for me because I didn't know anything when I went there about poetry, and I knew very little. I had read in the tradition, but I didn't know anything contemporary. I'm sure it's fine for some people. It's better than doing many other things, I think. I don't want to belittle it, but most people who go to graduate school in creative writing have had many such courses before. I hadn't, and this was all new to me, and it was exciting, quite exciting.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is, for all of us, I think, how to retain some wonderment about our existence in the world, and how to become a maker, the way other artists think of making something. I had to get over being what I call an utterer, somebody who would say, regardless of how interesting the stories were, would be interested in my own life that way. And then you realize, of course, nobody cares about your life. Maybe your wife or your lover or a couple of your friends, but even they may not care too much. You see a lot of that stuff. I remember Bill Matthews, poem about, he's a friend of mine, about Charles Mingus. And Mingus was kind of a bad guy and was, when Bill was about 18, he went to the village and heard him play and just loved it and wrote a poem in between sessions and brought it up to Mingus, and Mingus looked at him and he says, there's a lot of that going around. and then he fires his at the end of the poem, at least according to the poem, he fires his pianist. They get into a fight, and he comes out and says to the audience, "We've had a little diminuendo in personnel," which I love, and that's Bill was not only knew he was being entertaining and was probably telling a relatively true story, but he knew the tone and the measure of everything he was doing then. And it, for people who think their own lives are interesting, they rarely know the tone of how they're coming off.
As you're saying that, I'm thinking of memoir. I'm thinking of the memoir form and how you decide when you do have a story, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a whole other topic, but...
Yeah, well, I love V.S. Pritchett's remark on that. He says about memoir, "You get no credit for living." It's all in the art.
That's great. That's great. And back to Bill Matthews, I'm thinking of something I've heard that was attributed to him, which I've repeated, and I hope it was indeed, I believe it's something he said and that I saw somewhere, you know, quoted, in terms of writing and writer's perfectionism. He said, "Lower your standards."
He wasn't the one who said that.
Who said that?
He repeated it. I think that was Bill Stafford who said that.
Okay, all right. I still love it.
My favorite line of Bill's, it's an essay of his, is there are no such things as dull subjects. The dull subjects are subjects we have failed.
That's interesting.
He had a great epigrammatic sense.
How, you know, this, what you're talking about somehow reminds me of the poem toward the back of the book called The Widening.
Uh-huh.
I wonder if you would read that. It's on 83.
I will. Yeah, I suppose that's somewhat about storytelling. I will read the poem. The Widening.
Yes.
"I was holding forth at the dinner table, trying to fill what I perceived to be a void. I had just read a book on music, about which I know very little, and anticipating being corrected was saying something about the courage to have a full stop, the courage to break off, the breaking of rhythmic obligations. Then the phone rang. My daughter's lost cat had been found. I told everyone, and the void seemed to fill a little with good cheer, like vodka at the bottom of a glass. So I told him that the baby crow a hawk had tried to kill this morning was still alive, three birds of different species standing around it as if on guard. The hawk was up on a nearby branch, frowning, I said. No one smiled or laughed. But we were mostly a dour group, long-neglected reciprocity dinners finally acted upon, payback time. And the social scientists among us, who wouldn't know a good story unless research confirmed it good, wanted me to name the three species. Flew Fly, Plutarch, Dicky Doo. I couldn't help myself, and the void widened again. I wanted to go home, but I was home. How about the hawk, my friend Bjorn, the clarinetist said, and the hungers of the strong? And by the way," he added, "there's no such thing as a full stop in music. Silence is a sound, an afterlife for anyone with an ear. I'd like to say I felt corrected, not betrayed. And when I began to talk about miracles and the Bee Gees singing Stayin' Alive and Travolta being reborn before our eyes, I'd like to say I didn't know why. Actually, I did, and didn't want to say. My mind had drifted from music and obligations to baseball, the beautiful choreography of its dreams and errors. I wanted to say there was some good stops at the right time and some luck. It's possible to survive. I wanted to tell them that in my ignorance I was serious And when things get lost or about to die, all kinds of thoughts are legitimate. It was my house, after all, and the floor was mine.
Oh, great. Thank you. That was Stephen Dunn reading from Lines of Defense. So after I read that poem, I started thinking about the narrator and if the narrator was you or if this was a persona. Because I imagined that if it were you, you might make your friends mad. And so I'm thinking this had to be one of your personas.
There is me in there, and there's this persona in there. None of this ever happened, I will tell you that. there's not a single thing that ever happened that's in the poem. Except that I had been talking to my wife, who's taking piano lessons again at a late age, about rhythmic obligations and when full stops in music. And that was in my mind before I began the poem. But the poem has had many shapes, and this was one that got revised a lot. I'm actually looking forward to reading it next week, because I'm going to read it at Southeast Missouri State, and my daughter is picking me up in St. Louis, where she lives. She's driving me there. She'll stay for the reading, and I will tell her in advance that I'll mention her lost cat, which never existed, and not to worry about that.
Well, you know, this is curious because just the idea that many writers in all genres tend to worry a bit about what people will think, the people they know and love and care about, what they will think about what they read of theirs. And you've taught a bunch. What do you tell your students about when they worry about that?
Well, there are things to worry about that. I think when I have written poems, they're a little too naked, a little too confessional. I try to be smart enough now not to publish them. And you end up writing things that are on your mind, and as long as I transform the experience to some degree, I feel comfortable publishing poems. But it has to be a transformative act in the act of composition. Otherwise, it's again, why should the reader is always thinking, I think if the reader's like me, what's in it for me? And I have a kind of semi-attractive speaker here who's somewhat of a pain in the ass, too. So you could trust him, perhaps.
Have you experienced fallout early on in writing poetry that was a bit too naked?
Yeah, sure. I remember once giving a reading, and my wife was in the audience, and These were not really confessional poems wholly, but a woman came up to her afterwards, my wife, and said, "How can you live with a man like that?" And she had good answers always for things like that, which was, "Doesn't that strike you as your experience too?"
Oh, that's great. I'm curious about the order of poetry in collections like this, and how you decide what goes first, how you decide what goes last, how you decide what to leave out. Will you say a little bit about that?
I don't know if I can. I'll try. some books have been easier to organize than others. This one, as I recall, had a lot of poems early on that were seemingly personal and maybe even slightly autobiographical. I know that the third section had poems that were largely, to my mind, no, I'm thinking, how many sections are there? Fourth section. There's a section of poems that were somewhat political.
Mm-hmm.
And it's happened in lots of ways. It's easy when you work thematically, like third or fourth book was called Work and Love, and the poems were organized that way. I had sections on work and sections on love. That was pretty easy. Otherwise, you know, it becomes somewhat arbitrary. I certainly want to put poems early in the book that will engage and make people want to read more. And I concluded with a poem that is actually a very important poem to me. I'm not sure why I concluded with it. It seems like it could have... It may have even been the first poem in the book for a while.
Sea Level.
Sea Level, yeah.
Will you read that?
Yeah. That's it's a poem about that difficult period where I had been with my wife for a long time and we divorced, and I found a great new love who remains my great love, and how to take that on. And I live now in Appalachia, in the mountains of western Maryland, and used to live in South Jersey, very flat land and a lot of scrub pines there. Here goes, sea level. Down from the mountains of Appalachia and the highs of new love, I've come across the extended monotonies of interstates, back to where scrub pines stand small at sea level. There's a house I left for good, if forever can ever be good, and there's the great Egg Harbor River, which widens here, and everywhere the visages of ghosts appear and disappear. I've come to visit the friends who've stayed casualties course, the dearest ones, who somehow have learned to live amid the messiness of allegiances, the turns and half-turns, of whom now to console, whom to embrace, and when. I pull into their driveway, wanting to tell them how it feels to have, for the first time, an undivided heart, a sudden purity of motive. But when I begin to speak, I realize I don't. I say it anyway, won't take it back. When their outside cat wants in, they let him in. Then he wants out. They accommodate. The cat is almost as lucky as I. No mountains here. I can see the afternoon sun on the horizon, hanging on, about to dip and be gone. Their yard is a dusty orange. I love the truth. I swear I do.
Thank you. That's wonderful. It's a wonderful poem.
Yeah, and that kind of violates everything I've been saying, I think, about that poem is it knew what it was doing from the beginning, but it found its moments. It kept on finding its language, and that would be another criterion for me.
Something else that I so like about your work is that there's always this very sort of mild self-deprecation running through everything.
Well, I think if not deprecation, complicity.
Okay. Yeah.
One or the other.
Sure.
I think that's how to earn the trust of the reader. If you're at all superior or telling the truth from on high, nobody's really going to trust you. I mean, those things have to be discovered moments for the reader, for the writer. And if they are truly discovered and organized and formed right, there'll be discoveries for the reader too, I think.
Hmm. Prior to this show, Tani Tanuvial has a show, and today she focused on poetry. And as I was driving in, I was listening, and she had a poet on. I think her name was Kim Rosen, or maybe it's a psychologist who found her way out of a depression through poetry, and said that she was in this deep, awful depression and found a cassette of poems and read them. She didn't plan to be a poet, but she memorized these poems, and the poems she felt helped to heal her and bring her out of this depression. And I was thinking about poetry as a healing force, and wonder what you think about that, beyond, you know, the people who are writing poetry because they want to be poets, or people who are reading poetry because they want to become better writers. But poetry is as a healing force. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Yeah, lots of them, I think. if it has been for me, it's been by total accident, and mostly, I mean, I'm one of those people who used to love Ingmar Bergman movies because they were depressing and so well done. That there's a joy for me in seeing or encountering experience in a poem that seemed just right, or got the world right. That I don't doubt at all that poems can be healing for certain people. I think it's a lousy motive for writing them.
Yeah, interesting. She was talking about how she found this cassette tape and she just started memorizing them, and they pulled her out. And I found that...
Well, I think that's fine, and I'm sure that happens for a lot of people. I find it thrilling to be spoken to intimately that way, and when I have been depressed and saddened or very joyous, I write bad poems.
Why do you think that is?
Because you're involved with yourself so much, you don't learn anything.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You don't discover anything. Your language, I mean, you have to... The ideal poem for me is a poem that constantly finds its next moment by what preceded it, not because of what happened to you yesterday.
Well, that sort of brings us to the end of the show, which is I'm so curious. You've had more success than most poets will ever see. And I am curious, if you're still, are you still growing as a poet?
I am. it's strange that I could say that with such conviction, but I really feel I'm still learning how to write poems. And I have a chapbook coming out in September from Saraband that is different than anything I've ever done in my life. And I wrote every poem without... They're about Mrs. Cavendish, who I made up. I didn't know anything about her. I didn't know who was speaking to her. And by the end of the sequence, I knew some stuff. And I'm very interested in how the poems will be received. I think Saraband is very excited by them, so I'm happy with so far.
Well, I'm excited too, because I'm excited anytime you have something coming out. So I'll be interested to see that one too. And I thank you so much for being here again and taking the time.
Hey, well, you ask good questions and you keep me going.
Well, it's a pleasure to talk with you.
Okay,
and to read your work. Thank you so much.
Goodbye.
That was Stephen Dunn. His latest book is Lines of Defense, and it's published by Norton. And non-poets will say, read poetry to become a better writer. And so I hope you are, whether you do that just this month because it's National Poetry Month, or whether you do it throughout the year. I hope you do it throughout the year. I love poetry and love to read it, and love Stephen Dunn, of course, is my favorite. So it's always a pleasure to have him on and read his work, read his new work, read his old work. I had to refrain from talking about his old stuff. I brought in an old collection. I didn't want to kind of take the focus off his new book, which is equally wonderful as his old stuff. Just, he can't do wrong in my book. We're at the end of our time. I thank you for being here with us and listening. This show, along with the others, will be podcasts on penonfire.com in the next week or so. I hope you check out the other podcasts there. The archive is at writersonwriting.blogspot.com. You can find pretty much any show we've done. And if you try to find one and it's not coming up, email me and I'll see what I can do. Again, you've been listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. See you next week.